Mark, this is Democracy Now!
So I'm pleased to say that President Biden will announce today an additional $250 million security assistance package for Ukraine. It will surge more capabilities to meet Ukraine's evolving requirements, and we'll deliver them at the speed of war.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin announces more U.S. aid for Ukraine days after a Russian airstrike killed at least 51 people in central Ukraine in one of the deadliest strikes since Russia launched its invasion. We'll go to Kyiv to speak with the former CNN correspondent Arwa Damon, who founded the humanitarian organization Inara. We'll also talk to her about Gaza, where she just spent 2 weeks.
How it is that the United States is allowing Israel to continue to besiege the Strip in such a way. And remember, it was on day one that Israel cut off electricity, water, and basically vowed to cut off, you know, any form of assistance.
Then to Fred Trump III, Donald Trump's nephew. He says President Trump once told him as they sat in the Oval Office that disabled Americans should just die.
And he goes, you know, those people, all those expenses, those people should just die. I'm Fred Trump. I'm the father of William Trump, a young man with complex disabilities. Donald has never asked and not once has ever met William, which is, frankly, he's missed out on a lot.
Fred Trump III is author of the new book, All in the Family, The Trumps and How We Got to Be This Way. He'll join us in studio. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The UN's warning more than a million people in central and southern Gaza received no food rations in August, adding to a beyond catastrophic situation in the war-torn Palestinian enclave. Gaza's health ministry, meanwhile, says Israel's hindering the delivery of polio vaccines as its military refuses to coordinate the entry of medical teams in southern Gaza. This all comes amidst ongoing Israeli aerial and ground attacks. Death wars were reported in Gaza City and the Nusairat refugee camp earlier today. In Khan Yunis, mourners grieve their murdered loved ones at Nasser Hospital, including this mother whose son was killed by an Israeli strike.
A cry of pain comes from the depths of my heart. I want the whole world to hear it. The sound of my pain burns like fire from within. My heart is heavy, full of pain.
As mass protests in Israel continue to demand a ceasefire and hostage release deal, Hamas has accused Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of continuing to block a deal as he refuses to withdraw Israeli forces from Gaza's border with Egypt. The U.S. Justice Department earlier this week indicted Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar and five others with terrorism and other charges over the October 7th attack in Israel. Israeli forces are continuing their deadly raids in the occupied West Bank, including in Nablus, Balata, Bethlehem, Hebron, and Ramallah. In Jenin and Tulkarem, Israeli troops withdrew after a 10-day raid, which killed a reported 36 people and left a trail of destruction. This is Wasfia Rahema from the Tulkarem refugee camp.
This was the worst night. Everyone left their homes, but I did not, because I am disabled. My nephews told me they are going to leave, and I told them I will not go anywhere. Whatever God's willing will happen. There were sounds of strikes here and behind the house. They raised everything. Look at it, the shooting and sound grenades. I was reading the Quran all night so that God will protect us. 78 years. I have never witnessed anything like this. From 1948 to 67 to all the intifadas and all that I have witnessed, but nothing was like this.
Earlier today, Israel's National Security Minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, called on Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to include the defeat of Hamas and other groups in the occupied West Bank as part of Israel's war objectives. Ben-Gvir has repeatedly called for Israel to annex the West Bank. In Georgia, authorities arrested the father of the 14-year-old suspect, who is admitted to killing two students and two teachers at Appalachee High School in the city of Winder on Wednesday.
He is charged with the following: 4 counts of involuntary manslaughter, 2 counts of second-degree murder, and 8 counts of cruelty to children. Mr. Gray, these charges stem from Mr. Gray knowingly allowing his son, Colt, to possess a weapon.
Earlier in the day, President Biden called for parents of underage shooters to be held responsible for gun deaths and reiterated his call on Congress to ban assault weapons and tighten gun control laws. The Georgia shooter's father had reportedly purchased the AR-15-style rifle used in the massacre as a Christmas present for his 14-year-old son last year, months after the teenager was questioned by authorities over online shooting threats. Meanwhile, in Chicago, authorities have charged a suspect with first-degree murder over the shooting death of 4 passengers on Chicago's L train Monday. 3 of the victims were sleeping when they were killed. Kamala Harris is calling for a 28% capital gains tax rate for Americans who earn over $1 million a year. While it's an increase on the current capital gains tax of 20%, Harris's proposal is more than 10% less than the nearly 40% capital gains tax rate President Biden has proposed. The Democratic nominee unveiled her plans while on a campaign stop in New Hampshire. Harris also announced plans for a $50,000 tax benefit for new small businesses, a tenfold increase on the current deduction of $5,000 for startup expenses. The Justice Department has accused Moscow of backing a sweeping election interference scheme. On Wednesday, Attorney General Merrick Garland said his agency had seized 32 domains and indicted 2 Russian nationals for carrying out a $10 million online misinformation campaign to influence U.S. voters, he said. The Justice Department says the state-owned Russia Today, or RT television network, bankrolled the influence campaign. CNN reports the funds were used to operate Tenet Media, which has published 2,000 videos across YouTube and other social media sites since it launched late last year. Tenet's 6 far-right Trump-supporting commentators have millions of online followers. Anger is mounting over the murder of the Ugandan Olympic marathon runner Rebecca Cheptegei, who died Thursday in Kenya of organ failure 4 days after her boyfriend doused her body in gasoline and set her on fire. Activists in Kenya are demanding authorities respond to the crisis of gender-based violence. Government data shows 40% of married women in Kenya have experienced intimate partner violence. In 2021, the Kenyan Olympic runner, Agnes Tirop, was stabbed to death by her partner, whose murder case is still ongoing. This is Milka Chimos-Chewa, another professional runner and friend of Rebecca Cheptegei.
I can say we are still in shock and in pain, especially as athletes. And this thing happening in Kenya, this is the second time an athlete is being attacked. You remember the case of Agnes Tirop. Now it has come to Rebecca. So we are not happy.
In public health news, the Democratic Republic of Congo received its first delivery of mpox vaccine doses on Thursday as cases continue to surge. The organization Gavi, a global vaccine alliance, said it hopes the virus can be contained with the rapid distribution of vaccines in order to prevent another global crisis on the scale of COVID-19.
Mpox, in particular, is actually happening in conflict areas. And access in conflict areas is not always guaranteed. Children are actually taking the highest hit because you have to look at the case fatality. The case fatality for children is much higher. So it goes without saying that children are actually then a high priority group.
Nicaragua's government has freed 135 political and religious prisoners accused of supporting anti-government protests following secret talks negotiated by the Biden administration. The prisoners were flown to Guatemala, where they'll have an opportunity to apply for U.S. residency. Since 2018, Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega has ordered the arrest of hundreds of political opponents, including many Catholic priests and bishops, while shutting down more than 5,000 civic organizations. The Biden administration's pressing Honduras to reverse its decision to end its long-running extradition treaty with the United States. Pressure on President Xiomara Castro has mounted since last weekend, when her brother-in-law, Carlos Zelaya, admitted to reporters he met in 2013 with the leader of a narco-trafficking operation who offered to support Castro's failed bid for the presidency that year. His admission came just days after the U.S. ambassador criticized Honduras's defense minister for meeting with his Venezuelan counterpart, who was indicted by the U.S. on drug trafficking charges in 2020. Last week, Honduran President Castro accused the U.S. and opposition groups of plotting a coup like the U.S.-backed ouster of her husband, then-President Manuel Zelaya, in 2009.
Decirles. I want to tell you a plan against my government is being hatched. The people must know it.
To see our coverage of that coup, go to democracynow.org. Authorities in Haiti have expanded a state of emergency to the entire nation amidst worsening gang violence. On Wednesday, Acting Prime Minister Gary Conil said he distributed weapons to the Haitian army and the national police in order to retake territory controlled by gangs. The order came a day before U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken's arrival in Haiti. On Thursday, Blinken met with Conil, where he praised the Kenyan-led international security mission in Haiti and urged Haitian officials to prepare for Haiti's first national election since 2016. Many Haitians have opposed the U.S.-backed mission, as past international interventions have contributed to political destabilization and humanitarian crises in Haiti.
Blinken is in the country to manage his interests and the interests of the United States, because the weapons with which the gangs operate come from the United States. He's not going to do anything for us. His visit is a joke.
Hunter Biden pleaded guilty to 9 federal tax charges Thursday, just hours before jury selection was set to begin in his trial. Though the surprise plea means he'll avoid a lengthy trial, Hunter Biden still faces up to 17 years in prison and fines of up to $1.3 million for crimes including tax evasion, filing fraudulent tax returns, and failing to pay $1.4 million in taxes from 2016 to 2019. Hunter Biden will be sentenced on December 16th by a Trump-appointed judge. Separately, Hunter Biden faces sentencing in November for convictions on 3 felony gun charges in Delaware. President Biden has repeatedly vowed not to pardon his son or commute possible prison sentences. Here in New York, federal agents have raided the homes of at least 4 top officials with the administration of Mayor Eric Adams. On Wednesday, agents reportedly seized phones and other devices from First Deputy Mayor Sheena Wright, Deputy Mayor for Criminal Justice Philip Banks III, NYPD Commissioner Edward Caban, and Timothy Pearson, a former high-ranking police official and top advisor to Adams. It's unclear why the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York ordered the raids. So far, Mayor Adams has not been charged with a crime. Last November, federal agents seized phones and a laptop from Adams' home and raided the home of his campaign treasurer as part of an investigation into whether the campaign received illegal donations from Turkey. Mayor Adams is a former police officer. In other news from New York, 50 activists were arrested Thursday at the final action of the Summer of Heat series of protests at the Citibank headquarters. Faith leaders, scientists, climate and peace activists gathered again in a joint protest to demand Citibank stop funding fossil fuel projects and an end to the war on Gaza. This is Maureen Stubblefield of the Climate Reality Leadership Corps speaking to the NYPD as she was being arrested.
Citibank is the largest winner of new fossil fuel exploration and extraction in the world. That's why we're here.
are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Coming up, as Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin announces more U.S. aid for Ukraine days after a Russian airstrike killed at least 51 people in central Ukraine in one of the deadliest strikes since Russia launched its invasion, we'll go to Kyiv. Stay with us.
Every time I shed tears in the last past years, when I pass through the hills, oh, what images return, oh, I am for the roots of the woods, that origin of all my strong and strength. Something in the hills. I lost something in the hills. I grew up in declivities. Others grow up in cities. My first love and soul.
I lost something in the hills by Shannon Lay. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin's announced more U.S. aid for Ukraine days after a pair of Russian airstrikes killed at least 51 people in central Ukraine in one of the deadliest attacks since Russia launched its invasion in 2022. Austin spoke at the Ramstein Air Base in Germany earlier today.
And friends, this is a critical moment. Time is of the essence, especially with winter on its way. And we must all step up our support, and quickly. So I'm pleased to say that President Biden will announce today an additional $250 million security assistance package for Ukraine. It will surge more capabilities to meet Ukraine's evolving requirements, and we'll deliver them at the speed of war.
While in Germany, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin met with the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who called on Western nations to send more arms to Ukraine.
At the same time as our advance in the Kursk region, the Russian army continues its offensive in Ukraine. The most capable units of the Russian army are involved in expanding the zone of occupation of our territory in the Donetsk region. This is a clear choice by Moscow. Putin wants more Ukraine to occupy than he wants security for Russia. He doesn't care about Russian land and people. He just wants to grab as much of our land and as many of our cities as possible.
Zelensky's comments come as Ukraine continues its incursion into eastern Russia. We now go to the capital of Ukraine, to Kyiv, where we're joined by Arwa Damon. She's a former senior international correspondent, CNN, but she's now the founder of the humanitarian group Inara. She recently returned from Gaza, which we will talk about as well. But given that you're in Ukraine's capital right now, and you were just in Kharkiv, where on Sunday at least 47 people were injured when a Russian missile strike on a shopping mall and sports center took place, seven children wounded, that attack occurring just, what, 2 days after another Russian strike on Kharkiv. Arwa Damon, if you can talk about the humanitarian situation in Ukraine right now and the places that you have visited.
Well, I actually went to the location of those strikes that happened in Kharkiv at the sports center. And, you know, people are obviously very shaken up because they have not really experienced this level of intensity of bombing in quite some time now. And what it did was force us and a number of other organizations to cancel some of the activities that we had planned. There's obviously great wariness in terms of bringing groups of people, groups of children together, given that, you know, Russia does tend to have a propensity to go after schools, hospitals, and other civilian targets. I met with a number of children that Inara does work with through our local partner in underground makeshift shelters. And I remember speaking to a little girl whose father was killed very early on in this war. And her grandmother was telling us about how still to date, and it's been, you know, well over 2 years now, whenever she goes to her father's grave, she just throws herself on top of it and sobs and sobs and has to be dragged away. And when you speak to those who are, you know, trying to help children in the mental health space, they talk about how this trauma is becoming deeply ingrained within the psyche, especially the psyche of the youngest. And it's becoming very difficult to try to actually build these programs that are needed to begin to help, you know, children to try to move forward and address their trauma. Because obviously, especially as we have been seeing, you know, with these more recent strikes, the triggers are constantly still there. People are in a better position and situation than they were in when I was last in Ukraine just over a year ago. But there are still some, you know, basic things that are needed, whether it's school supplies or different activities for children to be able to occupy themselves. It's also vastly different depending on which part of Ukraine that you're in. Kharkiv, for example, is accessible. The areas that are closer to the front lines obviously have much more significant and much more dire needs, ranging from, you know, everything from hygiene products to food.
Arwa, I want to go to a short video you filmed when you were in Kharkiv.
All of the schools have basically turned their basements into makeshift shelters.
Sophia.
Oh, hi, Sophia. How old are you?
Seven.
Her father was killed in the war.
So you've been working with a local NGO in Kharkiv to deal with the psychosocial effects on children of this ongoing war. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, so a lot of the activities, and remember, these are children that have mostly been displaced. Kharkiv's demographic has shifted drastically. Many of the sort of original inhabitants of the city have left, and it has become something of an internally displaced hub. There are hundreds of thousands of people from different parts of the country closer to the front lines that actually evacuated themselves to Kharkiv. Some of them have managed to find accommodation. Others are living in these dormitories because Kharkiv used to be a university city. What we try to do is everything from sort of group activities to art therapy, sports therapy, as well as one-on-one sessions when children are identified as needing that. But there is obviously a huge amount of need and very few resources that are available at this stage. The need by far eclipses what any organization is able to do on its own, although there are quite a few individual efforts that are happening. Of course, the great concern is that, you know, if these traumas within children are not addressed early on, they can then, you know, calcify, so to speak. And then you also have the trauma that parents are going through, especially mothers, because a lot of these families that we work with are right now single mother households. Fathers are either on the front line or they've stayed back, you know, even in occupied territories to sort of keep control and keep an eye on their homes. And so women, these mothers, are really struggling a lot emotionally at being separated from their husbands, but also at having to somehow find work and then somehow fill the role of both mother and father for their children.
And can you talk about the situation? You are in the capital, Kyiv, right now. You have the government resigning as part of President Zelensky's biggest shakeup of the administration. Among the resignations tendered are the foreign minister, Dmytro Kuleba, weapons chief, Alexander Komishin. What this means and the request for more weapons now that we just covered with Lloyd Austin saying there will be more weapons and U.S. weapons, the permission Zelensky continues to seek to be able to use them to attack Russia in Russia.
You know, I was actually talking to a number of people down in Kharkiv about, you know, America's support, the West's support for Ukraine. And the sense down there, at least, and not just among people there, but others that I've been speaking to as well, is that the U.S. is giving Ukraine enough so that it doesn't lose, but not enough so that it can actually make significant and needed gains. And there's a big level of frustration when it comes to this particular aspect. when it comes to, you know, the government, there are, of course, you know, frustrations with the way things are run. There are concerns about corruption existing within the government. There is a sense that maybe some sort of a shakeup does need to take place. But what it boils down to is people here are exhausted. This has been going on, you know, for well over 2 years right now. And they really want to begin to be able to see a way out. Those who are fighting on the front lines are exhausted. You hear a lot of people speaking about how many of these soldiers have limbs that have been amputated, how many of them are not sufficiently trained, and then they're being deployed out to the front lines because obviously, you know, Ukraine is drafting its male population into its fighting force. And so there's a lot of different dynamics that are happening at the same time. But there's also a sense that this is stagnating to a certain degree, which is why so many people want to see the U.S. actually, as they'll call it, properly support Ukraine so that Ukraine can start making gains instead of simply holding on to the status quo.
And then there are others who are talking about why isn't a ceasefire being negotiated, which actually brings me to the second part of where you just were, which was in Gaza. I'm wondering, as you tell Ukrainians about where you just were, what is their response to what's happening in Palestine?
It is a conversation that I did have. And actually, I was messaging with a friend of mine in Gaza, telling him, you know, yes, I've just arrived to Ukraine. And he said, you know, please pass on my regards to the children. And I hope people there are doing better. And I was passing this on to a number of Ukrainians that I was meeting with in Kharkiv. And they were expressing their deep empathy for what Gaza was going through. One woman who I was talking to said, you know, we see what's happening there, and we realize that as horrible as what's happening to us is, in a weird, bizarre, twisted kind of way, when we compare our situation to Gaza, we realize that we're lucky. And I was passing that on again to my same Gazan friend, and he drew reassurance from that. He said that, you know, knowing that people on the outside empathized with what they were going through made them feel as if they were a bit less alone. Because as he put it, and as anyone who's been through war will put it, you don't really understand what war is, what it means, what it does to your psyche, what it does to you physically, what it does to everything you know and you love and you live for until you've actually lived through it yourself.
Well, let's talk specifically now about Gaza, where you just were for 2 weeks. The UN is warning the humanitarian situation in Gaza remains, quote, beyond catastrophic, as more than 1 million Palestinians in Gaza did not receive any food rations in August amidst Israel's relentless assault. This coming as Gaza's health ministry says Israel's hindering the delivery of polio vaccines as it refuses to coordinate the entry of medical teams to parts of southern Gaza. This is Karim Yassin, a 10-year-old Palestinian boy in Deir al-Balah, Gaza.
We want to play with our friends, go to school, eat and drink, but this vaccination is of no use. It's only useful against polio, but the war has destroyed us. It has destroyed our houses. I wish I can play with my friends, go to school. I wish to eat and drink like I used to before.
And this is a Palestinian mother, Qadi Judah, who recently got her children vaccinated at Yafa Hospital in Deir al-Balah, where she's also volunteering for the polio vaccination campaign.
We are displaced from Deir al-Balah. I gave my children the polio vaccine to protect them from disease, but I can't protect them from strikes and from death unless you help us, just as you helped us and delivered the medications to us to protect our children. So please stand with us to stop the war so that our children can live peacefully and to continue their studies.
Arwa Damon, can you talk about the crisis in Gaza where you just spent 2 weeks?
I mean, let's start by talking about how it is that polio reemerged in Gaza after 25 years. And it really boils down to the fact that Israel has decimated every single aspect of any sort of infrastructure within the Gaza Strip, from sewage to water to electricity to you name it. And what has happened in Gaza right now is that you have a situation where piles and piles of trash are everywhere. Open sewage is running in the streets. Hygiene is just about impossible, made even more impossible, Amy, because we have not been able to get into southern or central Gaza hygiene or